What do you understand the goal of the Chinese Communist Party to be?
To be the dominant global power and to render us subordinate, humiliated, and increasingly irrelevant on the world stage. I mean, they talk about this. They talk about the triumph of their model and the decline of the capitalist-led system led by the United States.
That's Congressman Mike Gallagher, chair of the new and bipartisan House Select Committee on the Chinese Communist Party, explaining why he believes America is in a new Cold War with China.
The Cold War reminds us that we want this to stay cold. We don't want a hot war.
I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast.
The Select Committee will come to order.
Gallagher, a Republican from Wisconsin, recently held the committee's first hearing on the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party, or the CCP.
This is an existential struggle over what life will look like in the 21st century, and the most fundamental freedoms are at stake.
He's working closely with ranking Democrat Raja Krishnamurthy.
We must recognize that the CCP wants us to be fractious, partisan, and prejudiced.
A Marine Corps veteran who served two deployments in Iraq, Gallagher is now focused on deterring China's military.
The best thing we could do to prevent World War III is to arm Taiwan to the teeth, and there is bipartisan support for that.
Containing its global ambitions.
The real concern with TikTok is not just that the app can track your location, which it can. Do we want a CCP-controlled company to be the dominant media platform in America?
And rethinking America's relationship with one of its largest trading partners.
Part of our mission on the Select Committee on the CCP is to make the case to the American people as to why this is something they need to be concerned about.
But can he keep the committee's bipartisan mission on track?
I'm clear-eyed about the challenges and the partisanship in Washington, D.C., but I think we can identify that center of gravity.
Representative Mike Gallagher, welcome back to Firing Line.
It's great to be back.
You studied Arabic at Princeton and joined the Marine Corps to fight in the global war on terror. And in 2017, you were elected to Congress. You are now the chair of the new Select Committee on the Strategic Competition between the United States and the Chinese Communist Party, which held its first hearing at the end of February. You call the Chinese Communist Party, quote, the greatest threat to the United States. What made you realize that the CCP ought to be the central focus of your attention?
There were a few incidents that stand out. One actually happened in Iraq, oddly enough, when I met a fellow counterintelligence, human intelligence officer in the Marine Corps named Matt Pottinger, who is a Mandarin linguist and a real China expert. And that was the first time he started talking to me about China. And I thought, well, you know, it's all about the Middle East. So clearly I have the advantage. And we became great friends. And so we sustained that conversation over time. And then he obviously became Deputy National Security Advisor. But the real sort of road to Damascus moment for me was in 2015 when the Chinese hacked the Office of Personnel Management. And I, along with 20 million other federal employees and military service members, got a letter saying, your records have been compromised. And this was around the time that Xi Jinping was visiting the United States for an official visit. And it just suggested a massive disparity between what they were saying publicly and what they were doing privately. So that was my wake-up call that sent me on a path towards trying to educate myself, study the Chinese Communist Party, obviously not to the same level that guys like Matt have, but at least try to be as educated as possible and be effective as a legislator in Congress.
The Select Committee on the CCP is a bipartisan committee. You're working hand in hand with ranking member Raja Krishnamurthy. And the goals include exposing America's dependence on China, advancing policies to restore domestic supply chains, confronting China's human rights violations, making the case to deter the CCP aggression towards Taiwan and beyond, and preserving America's own global influence. Now, a 2022 Pew poll found that 62% of Americans view China as a competitor rather than as an enemy. Yet 70% of Americans view Russia as an enemy. Do Americans sufficiently understand the threat posed by the Chinese Communist Party?
I still think there's a tendency to conceive of it as a distant threat or an over-there threat or purely an economic threat as opposed to a clear and present danger or a threat to American sovereignty. Now, we have had recent incidents like the Chinese spy balloon incident that have brought that threat closer to home for Americans. But part of what we have to do, part of our mission on the Select Committee on the CCP is to make the case to the American people, to your average American living in Green Bay, Wisconsin, as to why this is something they need to be concerned about and what we can do together to counter it. The second thing I would say is we need to constantly, as we talk about China as a competitor or an enemy or whatever the phrase we're using, is make a distinction between the Chinese Communist Party and the Chinese people. The Chinese people are not our enemy. They're the primary victims of the CCP's repression. And the more we make that distinction, I think the more successful our efforts at public education can be.
Look, for at least the last two decades, the United States had worked towards integrating China economically with the idea that a liberalized economic system would lead to a liberalized political system. You even admitted into buying into this idea that China could become a more responsible member of the global community if it had a growing economy. Why, in the case of China, did this theory fail?
Well, I think the part of the source of the theory was a classic example of mirror imaging. We tend to sort of graft our own value structure onto foreign societies. And I would also draw a parallel to Russia. One of the things that we saw in the lead up to the Russian invasion of Ukraine was a tendency to discount the idea that Putin would do something like this. I mean, you had John Kerry out there saying, well, I thought we lived in the type of world where things like this don't happen. Again, a classic case of mirror imaging. And the lesson of Ukraine, in my mind, is when you have dictators and authoritarians telling you in plain language that they intend to do something, you shouldn't discount it just because it doesn't align with Western values. As for the failure more broadly of the responsible stakeholder hypothesis, I think it gets to another key part of the party structure and what we need to understand about Xi Jinping, which is that he has intensely studied the fall of the Soviet Union in an effort to learn from that fall and succeed where they failed. I mean, he talked about this in his earliest speeches as General Secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, but we just didn't pay attention because, again, too many people were still bought into that idea that by integrating them into the global economy, it would moderate their political behavior. They would become less aggressive abroad and less repressive at home. And indeed, the opposite happened in part because they sold the idea of a peaceful rise and responsible stakeholder hypothesis to a receptive Western audience. The final thing I'd say is there's a lot of people that want this to be true because they have a lot of money to make in China. So there's a financial interest underlying it as well.
Former National Security Advisor H.R. McMaster has said that the Chinese Communist Party presents a far greater threat than the Soviet Union ever presented. What do you understand the goal of the CCP to be?
To be the dominant global power and to render us subordinate, humiliated, and increasingly irrelevant on the world stage. I mean, they talk about this. They talk about the triumph of their model and the decline of the capitalist-led system led by the United States. And I do think this is a more complex threat than the Soviet Union for the reasons that General McMaster elucidated in the hearing, which is that we never had to contemplate a form of selective economic decoupling with the Soviet Union because our economies didn't really interact. But because we've been pursuing China's integration of the global economy, we're now trying to figure out, how do we reduce our dependency on Chinese manufacturing? How do we ensure that American dollars aren't subsidizing the CCP's military modernization or its genocidal ambitions? And that's a very difficult thing to do, given how exposed we are economically and financially.
So let me ask you about the terminology around the Cold War and the paradigm of the Cold War framing as a shorthand way to sell this to the American people and help the American people understand it. Because that was the last real strategic and serious competition we had. I've heard you use the phraseology of Cold War, and yet it suggests a certain kind of strategy that isn't going to work in this case, right? At least Americans understand Cold War strategy to mean containment. And of course, we can't contain China because we're intimately intertwined in our economy and in many other areas. So help me understand, you know, is there a disadvantage to using the language around the Cold War that doesn't quite translate? Are you sure the Cold War paradigm is the most useful paradigm to use?
I think the analogy is useful both for the similarities as well as the differences that it identifies with respect to the old Cold War. Like the old Cold War, this is a whole of society competition. We do need to have a long-term strategy. We need to revitalize and modernize all of our national security agencies and the instruments of national power. But there are important differences. The foremost one we just discussed, which is that our economic strategy has to be different because we are now finding ourselves in a position of selectively decoupling economically, whereas at various points in the old Cold War, we pursued various economic carrots to enhance our strategy or various trade incentives. I would say also the Cold War reminds us, and particularly I say this as someone from Joseph McCarthy's district, of the perils of going overboard, where it's perhaps most useful is that the Cold War reminds us that we want this to stay cold. We don't want a hot war. Indeed, the thrust of our efforts need to be deterring CCP aggression, particularly across the Taiwan Strait, so we don't find that this Cold War turns hot. The final thing I'd say is that we did not seek a Cold War. It is the CCP, and increasingly in partnership with Russia, Iran, North Korea, that has been waging a Cold War against us for quite some time. We are just now waking up to that fact. And that's why I find the analogy useful.
The rhetoric of Cold War, of course, Xi Jinping has pointed out that when we use it, it gives him an excuse to escalate his own rhetoric. He even said this week, quote, Western countries led by the U.S. have implemented all-round containment, encirclement, and suppression against us, bringing unprecedentedly severe challenges to our country's development. So, you know, there's an argument on the American left that the Cold War paradigm in our framing actually gives Beijing an excuse to ratchet up its own rhetoric and its own posture.
Well, I think what undermines that argument is the fact that when we had less bellicose rhetoric for the last decade, they were ratcheting up their aggression, their military modernization. They were building islands in the South and East China Sea. They were planting dangerous facts on those islands. You know, they were perfecting a concentration camp in Xinjiang autonomous region. So I'm not sure softer language will do anything to moderate their behavior. I would prefer in general that we speak softly and carry a big stick. I think that's overall the best approach for U.S. foreign policy. But it does us no good to mince words or say things that aren't true for fear of provoking Xi Jinping, because Xi Jinping is the aggressor here. Ours is a defensive strategy. We are trying to defend the free world from totalitarian aggression. We're not trying to take territory. We're not trying to remake any society in our image. We're just trying to prevent the CCP from exporting its techno-totalitarian model of governance or taking territory, i.e. Taiwan, by force.
Chinese leader Xi Jinping has created the most heavily surveilled state in history. And I'd like to dive into how Chinese surveillance tactics also impact Americans. You have described TikTok as, quote, digital fentanyl. Explain what makes TikTok so much more dangerous to a new audience than Facebook or Amazon or any other U.S.-based company that collects reams of data on Americans every day.
I should say, I stole that phrase from FCC Commissioner Brennan Carr, so I have to give him a footnote there. One, none of these highly addictive social media apps are good for us on some level. I think, you know, people like Jonathan Haidt and Greg Lukianoff have persuasively teased out the correlation between social media use and rising levels of anxiety, depression, and suicide, particularly pronounced among young females. But what makes TikTok different is the basic ownership structure. TikTok is owned by ByteDance, and ByteDance is effectively controlled by the Chinese Communist Party. Furthermore, the notion that a private company exists in China, I think, is tenuous at best, because all companies are subject to the whims of the Chinese Communist Party. And so that is the basic difference. Here in America, if the government demands something, there are at least protections for private companies. Mm-hmm. In China, those protections don't exist. So that's the fundamental difference. The other thing I think we have to concede is that the TikTok is so successful because the algorithm is better at addicting kids. And that's why the comparison to fentanyl, I think, is appropriate. The real concern with TikTok is not just that the app can track your location, which it can, and TikTok was caught like trying to track the location of journalists, and they lied about it initially, and then they blamed it on bad actors in the company. So the threat is not just that it could track your location or exfiltrate data. The threat is that increasingly it's a news source for young Americans. It's not just about dumb dance videos. It is a source of information. So the question we have to ask ourselves, do we want a CCP-controlled company to be the dominant media platform in America. And I have to believe we can come to a compromise in the form of forced sale to an American company that satisfies my national security concerns while still allowing the app to exist in some form.
You have co-sponsored legislation this week to ban TikTok from operating in the U.S. Just this week, Senator John Thune and Mark Warner, Democrat from Virginia, introduced bipartisan legislation to give the federal government new powers to potentially ban technologies from U.S. adversaries, including China. Do you support the Restrict Act?
This is the Thune-Warner bill. We're working with Thune and Warner to see if we can come up with a version in the House. The concerns I have right now is that it gives the administration the authority to ban TikTok, which technically it already has via the CFIUS process, and I'm not sure it would use those authorities. So I wouldn't want to pass a bill that would make people in Congress pat themselves on the back and say, hey, we cracked down on TikTok, we solved this problem, when it doesn't actually do the thing we want to do. So if we can strengthen certain provisions of the bill, I think there's a possibility we could get a bicameral compromise. And I think a bipartisan bicameral compromise that addresses this issue would be best. And so I think Senator Warner, Senator Thune are sincere in wanting to tackle this issue. They've talked both persuasively about the threat posed by TikTok. So we have some minor disagreements about the specific mechanics through which you address that threat, but I'm hoping we can overcome those.
You referenced how many Americans are getting their news on TikTok. Put that in concrete terms in terms of the 2024 election. Of course, there was a lot of focus placed on international interference in the 2016 election. What could the influence of TikTok look like in the 2024 election?
It could have a massive impact. I mean, merely by tweaking the algorithm, you could downplay certain narratives, you could intensify certain narratives, you could enhance the core narrative right now of the CCP wolf warrior diplomats, which is that America is a systemically racist, evil hellscape, and all cops are bad. I mean, they're parroting this propaganda online on our social media platforms, while at the same time, your average Chinese citizen doesn't have access to that information, doesn't have access to those platforms. So there's a basic lack of reciprocity when we talk about this. And so it could have a devastating impact on our elections. And again, it gets back to the core issue. We don't want to give an entity like the Chinese Communist Party that weapon with which to not only influence our elections, but influence our sense of national identity or intensify hostility between Americans. America Against America is the title of a book written by one of Xi Jinping's closest advisors. And it also describes the strategy that they've deployed quite effectively to pit Americans against Americans and make sure that we are focused on destroying ourselves and not confronting aggression coming out of Beijing.
We all know about spy balloons now, but I want to ask you about a less publicized potential threat. There's one Chinese company which makes almost 80% of the cranes that American ports deploy. These cranes can track information about materials that are shipped into the United States. The National Security and Pentagon officials are raising concerns about whether they're also being used as espionage tools. How concerned should we be, both that nearly all of these cranes come from China and that there is a potential espionage threat?
I think we should be very concerned because if you think about a potential confrontation with China over Taiwan, let's say Xi Jinping makes the decision, I'm going to take Taiwan by force, which he said he's willing to do on numerous occasions, by force if necessary. It would be naive to assume that Las Vegas rules apply to Taiwan, that what happens there would stay there. In every war game I've played, the situation quickly escalates to include attacks on the American homeland. And they may not necessarily be kinetic attacks. It may not necessarily be a hypersonic glide vehicle hitting a munitions production facility in the heart of America. It could be a cyber attack against our infrastructure, or it could be an attack on our ports using some of this smart crane technology in an effort to prevent us from surging materiel and equipment to the Indo-Pacific region, which would be necessary. The other thing that happens in every war game I've played is we quickly run out of ammo within the first 2 weeks. And so we need to surge ships, we need to surge long-range fires, we need to surge human beings to the Pacific in order to prevail in that flight. So I think the spy balloon has actually shown the dangers of thinking about this as an over-there problem, and that in any Taiwan scenario in particular, the American homeland would absolutely be a target. And we're hoping to tackle this crane issue in one of our field hearings and something we do with the committee members, take them to a port, see the issue up close and personal, and then identify productive legislation to combat it.
I want to ask you about the CCP's influence campaign abroad. This includes by foot soldiers who are part of the United Front Work Department, which you've described as, quote, the least understood, but perhaps most insidious form of CCP aggressions. What do you want Americans to understand about the CCP's United Front Work Department?
Well, Xi Jinping has called this his magic weapon. And the United Front Work Department is, you know, many times bigger than our own State Department. So this is a way in which they capture and corrupt foreign elites. They corrupt foreign institutions. And I say it's insidious because oftentimes it's very subtle. What we're trying to do is educate members of Congress on what United Front Work is, this combination of intelligence operations, economic coercion, and influence efforts, and to also make them aware that they are targets for United Front Work. And increasingly, they are soft targets. So it may take the form of a donation to an American university that is given in the name of a group that, you know, you start to tease out a connection or two, and then it's, you know, directly affiliated with the United Front Work Department. That's problematic. We don't want our American universities to be suppressing certain lines of research or inquiry just because they don't want access to Chinese money. It could take more overt forms in the form of illicit Chinese police stations on American soil that are registered under nonprofits that are then being used to harass and surveil Chinese dissidents on American soil. Or it could take the form, again, on an American campus of a CCP-aligned student group being used to harass and in some cases physically assault Chinese students or Taiwanese students just because they've said things critical of the regime in Beijing. So we want to educate the members about what United Front Work is and then identify ways where we can counter it.
There have been a string of U.S. criminal cases connected to alleged CCP spying in the academic world. There's a Chinese scholar at UCLA who was convicted of shipping banned missile technology back to China. There's the case of Charles Lieber, the former chair of Harvard's chemistry department, who was found guilty of concealing financial backing from the Chinese government. He received grants of more than $1.5 million to create a research lab at the Wuhan University of Technology in China as part of Beijing's 1,000 talent recruitment program. I think what you're saying is American universities are soft targets.
They're very soft targets. And again, Chinese students are very lucrative for American universities. They often pay full tuitions. There's something called Section 117 of the Higher Education Act, where universities are supposed to disclose foreign donations in excess of $250,000. It was not being enforced. The Trump administration started enforcing it, and they discovered $6.5 billion worth of unreported donations. That money has dropped off, not because the money has stopped flowing into American universities, but we're just not enforcing that anymore. So at a minimum, we need to be committed to transparency. I will concede it's very difficult sometimes to draw the line between, let's say, a purely civilian researcher and someone who's a PLA-affiliated researcher. But that's also why we need to do a better job of developing expertise when it comes to United Front Work, in particular, in China in general, in our intelligence community, in our law enforcement community, so that they can work productively with these institutions to make sure that they aren't soft targets or that they can become harder targets going forward.
There's a criticism that some of the cases around academia are actually the result of a xenophobic panic. How do you respond to that?
I think the most important thing we can do is to draw that distinction I talked about a little bit earlier, which is that this isn't about targeting the Chinese people. This is about the Chinese Communist Party and its efforts to undermine American sovereignty. And the more mindful we are of that basic distinction, I think we can counter any sort of accusation of xenophobia. And of course, how we conduct ourselves on the Select Committee will be key towards that effort. It's why the Speaker has been so intent on making this a bipartisan effort. That's what he's told me repeatedly. We just had something I've never seen in my 6 years in Congress, not just a extremely bipartisan hearing, but a meeting with Speaker McCarthy and Majority Leader Jeffries, in which they both said, we want this to be bipartisan. So I think the more we can work together, the more we can also guard against that accusation and balance what we're trying to do against the CCP narrative.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken said in late February that Beijing is considering providing weapons to Russia in its war against Ukraine. The Biden administration has also said that if China provides lethal support to Russia, it would be crossing a red line. Do you think Xi Jinping will cross the red line?
Well, I think Director Burns is engaged in a very useful effort to try and deter Xi Jinping from doing that. And I think communicating in no uncertain terms that this would be a red line is a wise move. And I do think there would be overwhelming bipartisan support for some form of economic punishment in the form of a sanction from Congress if indeed China decided to cross the red line. I guess what I fear is that we've repeatedly underestimated the depths of this no limits partnership between Xi Jinping and Vladimir Putin. When they signed the no limits pledge around the Olympics, we thought, well, this is just a piece of paper. And then Xi Jinping has stood by Vladimir Putin as he's invaded Ukraine. Increasingly, I think Xi views Putin as his junior partner in this de facto alliance to undermine the West. He's tethered goat in Europe, his agent of chaos. And so I think there's a real risk that he will go forward with providing lethal assistance to Putin because it serves his interest. And we need to be prepared to respond in a bipartisan fashion if that happens.
Banking sanctions?
I think a very strong sanctions package would be on the table in that scenario.
What else?
Well, if you look at our overall strategy vis-a-vis the Chinese Communist Party, certain things are obvious. We need to do more to enhance deterrence in the Indo-Pacific. I just came back from Taiwan, and my biggest takeaway was the fact that we have a $19 billion backlog of foreign military sales items that have been approved but not delivered. That's unacceptable. That's an area where I really think we can work in bipartisan fashion to clear that backlog and make sure that we don't repeat the same mistakes we made in Ukraine, which is to say to rely solely on soft power to deter and not put hard power in Xi Jinping's path. That's the best thing we could do to prevent World War III is to arm Taiwan to the teeth, and there is bipartisan support for that. We've talked a lot about sort of the economic components of our strategy. I just would say that one thing that I think is missing from our economic statecraft is a proactive, positive agenda on trade. Another thing I took from my trip to Taiwan was that they are desperate for a 21st century trade agreement leading to a free trade agreement with Taiwan. And it seems that both parties have abandoned the trade agenda in recent years. So figuring out how we do that, how we adopt a post-Brexit gold standard trade agreement with the UK, how we use the AUKUS agreement to enhance our technological cooperation with the Aussies and the Brits, that needs to be part of our strategy. Perhaps the most difficult component of this is what I call ideological competition. How do we convince the American people that in this competition, we are the good guys, that we deserve to win because we believe in American values of free expression, freedom more broadly, that is something worth fighting for and something worth sacrificing for?
I'm glad you mentioned your recent visit to Taiwan and your meetings with President Tsai Ing-wen. Another component of the geopolitical arrangement with Taiwan is, of course, semiconductors. 90% of the world's most advanced semiconductors, of course, are produced in Taiwan. And, you know, you didn't vote for the CHIPS and Science Act, which created more than $50 billion in subsidies and tax breaks to incentivize U.S.-based companies to build up the semiconductor sector here in the U.S. I just want to be clear. You support measures to build up semiconductor production outside of Taiwan. Correct?
I do. I want to make sure that, however, in doing that, we don't undermine our deterrent posture with respect to Taiwan. They talk about their semiconductor dominance as a silicon shield. So we just need to be careful about how we do this and constantly signal to our friends in Taiwan that we are going to do everything in our power to help them defend themselves. The other problem with the CHIPS Act right now that even proponents are discovering is that without more aggressive regulatory reform, NEPA reform in particular, a lot of these chip fabs aren't going to be built on a timeline that makes sense if you're concerned about a prospective invasion of Taiwan within the next 5 years. The same criticism could be levied against all of our infrastructure projects and how long it takes to get these things approved. So I'm open to creative proposals going forward, but I had concerns at the time. But we do need to think about when it comes to certain areas, advanced pharmaceutical ingredients, rare earths, energetics, the things that are in our weapon systems, what is the right mix of state and federal funding or incentives that produce that results in onshoring or nearshoring. We can't do it everywhere. It's got to be selective, right? We have no problem if farmers want to sell soybeans to China or if Americans want to buy cheap textiles from China. But when it comes to key industries, for example, we don't want the CCP to be able to cut off the export of life-saving drugs in order to humiliate us or bring us to our knees. Well, there's going to have to be government action.
To that point,
yeah.
90% of the antibiotics in the world are produced in China. 70% of acetaminophen is imported from China. So I appreciate this approach that we have to be thoughtful about selective decoupling. So how do you think about that?
It's a massive problem. I think back to the earliest parts of the pandemic when they threatened to cut off the export of APIs to plunge us into a sea of coronavirus. I think about it as a military analyst as something that we never factor into these war games that we play over Taiwan. And what would be the effect of if they actually cut off the export of life-saving drugs? That would probably affect how the American people think about that conflict. So it's not an easy thing to solve overnight, but one thing we're trying to do in the Select Committee's work is figure out, is there a bipartisan path forward that meaningfully secures our supply chain and meaningfully reclaims our economic independence? And pharmaceuticals is a key area.
Let me just go back and put a bow on the semiconductor piece because you mentioned the Silicon Shield.
Yep.
The Silicon Shield is this notion that somehow Taiwan is protected from invasion because it has a near monopoly on these advanced semiconductor chips that it produces. On the flip side, does increasing the places where we produce semiconductors, like producing them in the United States, undermine Taiwan's security?
Well, my hope is that if we get our signaling right, both in terms of what we say about our support to Taiwan, and I, for example, have been a proponent of clarifying our policy of strategic ambiguity. So right now, we don't really say if we would definitively defend Taiwan. I think it would actually enhance cross-strait stability if we were clear and said in no uncertain terms, if the CCP tries to invade, we will defend Taiwan. It's a separate argument. But if we improve our signaling, and if above all, we improve our denial posture, our deterrence by denial posture, by clearing the backlog of FMS items, increasing our naval presence in the region, ironing out our basing agreements with Japan and the Philippines, putting small teams of Marines on those islands in southern Japan and northern Philippines in order to target PLA ships. I think we can navigate that balance, but we have a long way to go on the military front. And we've been saying things for years, but we haven't actually been doing the things. We haven't actually been meaningfully improving our military posture in the region. That's what we need to do.
So we haven't learned our lesson from Ukraine.
Not yet. And Ukraine has also exposed the fragility of our munitions industrial base. These are systems that we just haven't produced at a maximum rate for years. Javelins, Stingers, Harpoons, things like that. We need to use this moment in order to revitalize Freedom's Forge, revitalize the arsenal of democracy, and do simple things like maximum production rates for key munition systems, using multi-year procurement authority to stockpile these munitions. And oh, by the way, because Taiwan is an island, it makes it harder to conquer, but it makes it much more harder to resupply. Those weapon systems need to be delivered before the shooting starts. It's going to be much harder to deliver harpoons or other weapon systems after deterrence has collapsed. And again, putting that hard power in Xi Jinping's path is our best chance of preventing a war in the first place.
You just said it a second ago. You are in favor of clarifying our previous position, which had been one of strategic ambiguity. That had been the position of the United States for decades. What would you suggest the articulation of our new policy be?
That we will defend Taiwan if Xi Jinping tries to take it by force. I will, however, concede that what matters far more than strategic ambiguity or strategic clarity is strategic capability. The actual weapon systems we have both on Taiwan, the ability of the Taiwanese to fight and our ability to work with them and train them on certain systems, the resilience of their critical infrastructure and our critical infrastructure from a cyber perspective. And then, of course, you know, the actual things that the United States Navy and the United States Air Force can do in the Indo-Pacific. So that has to be the main effort. But I do think strategic clarity would help reduce the chance of a miscalculation across the Taiwan Strait.
And you also believe it would help reduce the chance of actual war.
I do. This sort of gets to the paradox of deterrence, though. In order to prevent a war, you need to convince the bad guy that you are willing to go to war. And that's, you know, that's actually evident in the previous three Taiwan Strait crises. That was evident in the first two in the 50s. Eisenhower had to surge American hard power, put Matador cruise missiles on Taiwan itself. In the 90s, Bill Clinton had the largest show of U.S. military force since the Vietnam War. Diffusing a fourth Taiwan Strait crisis is going to require that level of resolve and leadership from an American president.
This program, Firing Line, was originally hosted by William F. Buckley Jr. for 33 years. Buckley held debates on relevant topics. And in 1997, Firing Line hosted a debate about whether the United States should be trading with China. William F. Buckley Jr. and Arianna Huffington debated trade with China and human rights.
And as we pledge always, in language and accents unmistakably clear to the world, to deplore the hideous treatment by the Chinese government of those brave people who struggle to practice freedom of political action and of conscience.
They know all too well what is going on in China. They know all too well about the slave labor camps, about the forced abortions, about the torture and execution of dissidents. So, what is left? Why do they turn a blind eye to what is happening? It's because they value free trade more than they value freedom, commerce more than justice, and the rule of money more than the rule of law.
Human rights continues to be a major problem for the Chinese Communist Party. The CCP is currently sponsoring a genocide against a Muslim minority, the Uyghurs, in Xinjiang province. The West acknowledges that this is a genocide. Mm-hmm. What do we need to know about the values of a government that is willing to commit a genocide on its own people?
I think we need to understand that this threat won't just be contained to the Xinjiang Autonomous Region, that they are perfecting this model of techno-totalitarian control, and they're going to export it not only throughout the borders of China, but increasingly would like to see a world that looks more like Xinjiang. There's a saying in Silicon Valley that the future is already here, it just isn't evenly distributed yet. Well, in Xinjiang, we're getting a preview of the future that Xi Jinping wants for the world. And if America stands for anything, it should stand against genocide, it should stand for human rights. We made the decision to de-link human rights from our trade policy in the late 90s and early aughts with the benefit of hindsight. That was a mistake. We need to be clear that America will not stand idly by while this is happening. It's why I think it was very productive for us to pass the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act in a bipartisan fashion. And one of the things we need to do on the Select Committee is to conduct basic oversight to make sure that that's actually being enforced so that we're not dependent on slave labor in
Xinjiang.
How
is enforcement going?
I think it's very embryonic right now. I think I think there's a lot of companies that have questions about how do they comply with it. There's a question about how you certify that your supply chains don't sort of run through Xinjiang. And then what we're discovering, not just in the defense industrial base, but in every sort of industry, is that sometimes people don't have a full visibility into their supply chain. And you start to go down one or two layers and they can't answer basic questions. So I think we have a lot of work yet to be done on enforcing that. There's also a concept embedded in the bill, this rebuttable presumption. That's a concept whereby the onus is on the companies to make the case that they're not using slave labor in Xinjiang. I think that concept is very useful and we could extend that into other areas of economic
statecraft. But is that plausible deniability?
We're not giving them plausible deniability. We're sort of shifting the onus on the private sector. We're sort of assuming that the supply chains might be compromised and they have to prove to us that they're not. So it's a massive paradigm shift for the U.S. government.
You've said, Nike is one of these companies who actively lobbied against the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. Many American companies and industries, frankly, are tied in knots in the context of their businesses and their assets and their investments in China. One is the NBA, another is Apple. In 2020, you said, I think we have to subpoena the CEOs of Apple, Hollywood executives, and the NBA just to get a better understanding for the American people about how China is leveraging its economic power to coerce American citizens and craft certain narratives that are really damaging around the world. Tell me more about that.
Well, I think we saw this with Hong Kong play out in the NBA in particular. And I think a lot of people raised concerns because when you had an executive or speak out in support of the Hong Kong protesters, it seemed like he was quickly silenced. There was a lot of criticism from players, from executives, and the concern seemed to be, well, let's not compromise the business that we have in China. That is troubling for a lot of Americans. We want American companies to act like American companies in support of American values. And if you remember, the protesters that were on the streets in Hong Kong, as the CCP was taking over, were in many cases waving American flags. They were looking to us for leadership. So I get it. I don't begrudge the effort from major American companies to make money all around the world. And I understand that China is this massive market. but we don't want to allow the CCP to use access to their market as a weapon to silence Americans and undermine American values. So I think we can have a productive conversation with Disney, with the NBA, with Apple. I genuinely want to understand how they think about doing business in China. I get that the federal government and the American economy is a massive aircraft carrier. It doesn't turn on a dime. And we've been shifting our policy on China. It's not going to happen overnight. But we have to have that conversation, difficult though it may be at times.
What would you like to hear from the CEO of Apple, Tim Cook?
I would like to hear more about the details of some of the recent agreements that they've made with the Chinese government. I'd like to hear of how they think about their overall manufacturing presence in China. I'd like to hear about how they think about human rights abuses in China, how they think about recent legislative efforts like the Uyghur Forced Labor Prevention Act. And my hope is that would stimulate a broader discussion with my colleagues and the American people about how we all think about technological dependence on manufacturing in China. I mean, everyone has an iPhone, right? I mean, components are made in China. So again, I know this is very, very difficult, but this is what we've been tasked by the speaker to do. And again, I think this is the most complex aspect of our competition, this economic statecraft component. I think over time, if we get the policy right, if we send the right signals from Washington, D.C., we can gradually start to reduce our dependency on China. We can diversify our supply chains. We can de-risk is the new phrase that industry is using. And on balance, I think that's healthy. And we'll discover enhanced partnerships, economic and otherwise, with countries like Vietnam, with countries like Indonesia, with the Philippines, countries we've been neglecting for a long time just because we've been distracted.
The Washington Post editorialized this week, applauding the Select Committee's first hearing. It wrote, quote, "It is all too rare these days to see House members working across the aisle on shared and serious sense of purpose. So we should applaud even tentative signs that it is still possible." Your ranking member, Representative Raja Krishnamoorthy, speaking to why it was so important for the committee to operate in a bipartisan fashion, said, quote, "The CCP wants us to be fractious, partisan, and prejudiced." What message does having a bipartisan committee send to the CCP?
Well, I think what the CCP, to echo Raj's sentiment, what they fear more than anything is Republicans, Democrats working together to defend America and American sovereignty from CCP aggression. And I think, you know, listen, we're not going to agree on everything. I've been in Congress for 6 years now. I'm clear-eyed about the challenges and the partisanship in Washington, D.C. But I think we can identify that center of gravity. I think we can figure out, okay, what's the 70% that Republicans and Democrats and really the world agrees upon when it comes to China? We may agree to disagree on the remaining 30%, but I think this committee can be a vehicle for serious, sober, strong policy that puts us in a better competition to win the short-term sprint and also the long-term marathon when it comes to our strategic competition with the CCP.
Even as 2024 heats up, how are you going to continue to maintain that bipartisan balance?
Well, I'm just going to stay ruthlessly focused on the committee's work. Having been on the presidential campaign, I understand how nasty they can get. But I think one measure of our success on the committee, or what I'm hoping will happen, is that when both parties start to identify, okay, what is our platform on China, they look to the committee's work as a place where forward-leaning, innovative policy is being developed and discussed. And to the extent possible, though politics has never stopped at the water's edge, we want to the extent possible, be projecting a united front to counter the CCP's united front.
Choice words. One more question. Former President Trump this week called for those arrested for their role in January 6th violence to be released. He cited selectively edited security videos that aired on Fox News by Tucker Carlson that were provided to him by Speaker McCarthy. President Trump claims those videos proved the defendants were victims of, quote, a radical left con job. You were in the Capitol on January 6th. You were on this program on January 7th, 2021. At that time, you called the actions of the rioters pure, lawless mob behavior. Have you seen anything since then that changes your assessment of what happened that day?
Well, I haven't seen any of the videos that have been discussed in recent weeks. I think my understanding is that if there's someone who's been detained that thinks they were wrongfully detained or wrongfully punished, their lawyers have the ability to go view the videos. And as long as it doesn't compromise anything from the Capitol Police perspective, they have access to that. My basic view is if you broke the law, if even breaking a window, which would be the same, you know, if you did that in Green Bay, Wisconsin, I would not be cool with that. And certainly if you did it in the United States Capitol, I would not be cool with that. If you broke the law, you should be held accountable. Now, you shouldn't unduly punish people that didn't break the law, but we need to have respect for rule of law. As for January 6th, obviously I didn't object. I don't think that Congress has the authority to overrule the will of the states. I made my views known. But beyond that, I think we just, you know.
So my question is there anything that has changed your mind about what had happened that day?
Nothing that's changed my mind. Yeah. I think the more that's out there, though, provided we're not compromising anything from a capital security perspective, the better. I think sunlight is the best disinfectant. And so my hope is that that will be, you know, people will examine the full amount of video and data that's available, and we can have a sober discussion about it as opposed to just a partisan discussion.
Mr. Chairman, what you're doing in your committee is having a sober, thoughtful, nuanced conversation about public policy that's enormously important to the United States. And I wonder, in a bipartisan way, as you continue to do this, is it going to become increasingly difficult as the specter of Donald Trump's renomination to the Republican Party ticket in 2024 becomes all the more possible?
I don't think so. I think for the last 6 years in Congress, I've been able to focus on my work on the Armed Services Committee in particular. And at times of intense partisanship, that work continued. And every year we're able to pass the National Defense Authorization Act. And on China, I think the untold story of the last 6 years has been how bipartisan that work has been. I mean, obviously, politics gets in the way of a lot of things. That's inevitable. I'm not naive about that. But I'm going to do my best to lead the committee in a way that sets a tone of statesmanship, where we have disagreements, we can have those, I think, in an honest fashion, in an open fashion, but always try and look for how do we move the ball down the field. And again, it's about defending America from the pattern of aggression that we're seeing from the CCP, and that should be something that unites Americans, not divides them.
If Donald Trump is the Republican Party's nominee in 2024, do you rule out supporting him?
Well, I said 2 years ago that he lost my support. I'm not going to change that. I think we have a ton of really good candidates. My own bias would be for a non-boomer candidate, a younger candidate. So we'll see. We're going to have a debate. I look forward to seeing what the candidates have to offer.
These are exciting times, Congressman. Thank you for returning to Firing Line, and thank you for your leadership on these important national security issues.
Thank you.